Welcome to New Books in Language. Today I'm talking to Ingrid Piller about her book Linguistic Diversity and Social Justice, which critically examines the role that language plays in bringing about social outcomes. In this interview, we discuss how language abilities come to be treated as a proxy for other social factors and can be implicated in discrimination. We look at how the perception of bilingualism interacts with other cultural considerations, and we consider some of the ways in which formal education can propagate social injustice. Today I'm talking with Professor Ingrid Piller about her book Linguistic Diversity and Social Justice, which is a wide-ranging exploration of the societal consequences of language use. Ingrid, how did you come to write this book?
Hi, Chris. Thanks a lot for having me on the show, and thanks a lot for the question. Look, I've been working in bilingualism and language learning and intercultural communication for almost 20 years now, both as an academic, as a researcher, and also as a practitioner in language teaching and with adult migrants. One of the, particularly here in Australia, and one of the roles I had was as executive director of a research center devoted to a migration program and language teaching program that we have here in Australia. It's called the AMEP, that stands for Adult Migrant English Program. And the Adult Migrant English Program was founded after the war to help new migrants, particularly from Europe at the time, to find their feet with English in Australia. And it has been funded by the federal government ever since in various levels. And so Australia, as a multicultural and migration society, is very aware of the challenges faced by new migrants who may not be speaking English or may not be speaking it very well, and has over the years done quite a lot to address those problems. At the same time, in my research and also in my encounters with many, many migrants, with many teachers in the migrant space, with policymakers, it also became increasingly clear to me that, you know, despite the best efforts that everyone puts into learning a new language and teaching a new language and supporting new migrants, a language still acts as a way that stratifies access to resources in our society. And seeing that Australia has in many ways been very, very supportive of the language learning in a way that has not been the case in other migration destinations really motivated me to explore the role of language in social stratification much more. And I just wanted to bring this kind of issue to the attention also of a wider audience and start wider conversation, because we are very aware of the way social inequality is related to gender in particular, to race, to ethnicity, but language somehow works differently. We don't quite see it as such a problem, and partly that has to do with the fact that most of us assume that language is something you can change easily. It's seen as an aspect of our identity that is quite different from, say, gender, which, you know, is very difficult to change, or racial identity, which also seems much more difficult to change and less fluid. Whereas with language, we tend to think, well, if you try hard enough, then you'll be able to learn a new language, and migrants will be adapting to the new language environment. But as my research and the research of many, many others has shown, that's, of course, in no way the case. Language learning for adults is a very, very difficult undertaking and takes years, a lifetime, to succeed. There always is the aspect of linguistic difference in a society. And now that, you know, migration has become so important globally, not only in Australia, I thought it would be good to use the Australian experience to explore the role of language in social inequality more systematically. And that was the motivation for the book.
Yes, indeed. Something that comes up in that answer, which you confront throughout the book, is the fact that the relationship between language diversity and social stratification mm-hmm. is obviously a very complex one, and that there are lots of other factors in play. Mm-hmm. And also that it's sometimes misunderstood, with linguistic diversity either being blamed for or credited with effects that are actually due to other social causes. How do you go about untangling that web?
Look, as you say, in many ways, it's almost impossible to untangle, right? It's a very complex story, and language often comes to stand for other things. So that's the first observation. The first observation I started with was I tried to isolate what are language effects in social justice. My focus was on social inequality because I wanted to start with real world problems. So my approach is not one to that is sort of a normative justice approach. It's a very practical and pragmatic approach that starts from the question, what are social problems that are related to linguistic diversity, and where does language diversity serve maybe as a cover for discrimination or discrimination that has become illegitimate? And so I'm trying to look at how does language structure social justice, and social justice I conceive as consisting of three facets. One is economic inequality. So one of the questions I ask is, how is language related to economic inequality? The particular focus here is on access to jobs, access to employment. The second question I ask is, social justice can also be conceived as one of equality of cultural representation, or conversely as a problem of cultural domination. So where is language implicated in the way we see people as not as meritorious as others? How does language serve to justify in our minds and legitimize inequality? And the third question I ask is, how is linguistic diversity implicated in parity or imparity of political participation and community participation, starting from the Human Rights Declaration of the United Nations? Community participation is seen as something that is fundamental to be able to live a just and meaningful life, that you can equally and everyone can freely enjoy public participation. And so I ask, how does language or language proficiency, or the language arrangements we have in the society, how does that constrain public participation? So that's the overall approach that I'm taking. So it's a very pragmatic approach that starts from social problems, starts from social justice, and conceives social justice as related to economic inequality, to cultural domination, and to imparity of political participation. Having said all that, as you say, it's really, really difficult to entangle language and language proficiency and aspects of linguistic discrimination from other forms of discrimination. And one of the fundamental findings or the fundamental convictions of social activists is that inequality and discrimination often is a multifaceted phenomenon. There are all these intersections of, and one can sort of suffer from multiple inequalities. If women of color tend to be more disadvantaged than white women, right, if we look at it from a gender perspective. And so there is often the burden of cumulative disadvantage, and language can be one aspect of cumulative disadvantage, that people who are already disadvantaged because they are working class, because they are poor, because they have minority status in one way or another, because they have complex migration trajectories, refugees, and so on and so forth, language becomes another facet of their disadvantage, of their cumulative disadvantage. Additionally, language can actually serve as a pretext for discrimination that is no longer legitimate. And in Western societies, it has now, of course, become illegal to express or to engage in racial discrimination. However, language is still a prejudice that can serve as a pretext for racial discrimination. So if for, let's talk about a job interview, for instance, if you are so inclined and tell someone, I'm not giving you this job because your language proficiency is not good enough, that we see as legitimate discrimination. However, how does an interviewer decide whether the language proficiency of a job applicant is adequate or not? Very often, that's sort of a global judgment that very well may link in with the appearance or the general prejudices that the interviewer has against the applicant. And so language discrimination can become a front, a show front, if you will, or a shop front for other forms of discrimination.
Yeah, I mean, taking up that particular point, this is something you talked about, I think, before, where you point to the inadequacy of simplistic assumptions that are sometimes made about how language ability automatically confers access to the labour market. Do you feel that we're blasé about that?
I think in particularly in Anglophone societies, there certainly is something that the sociolinguist Michael Klein has called the monolingual mindset. And what he means by talking about the monolingual mindset is that there is an assumption that English is enough, and that really to be only speaking English is the normal state of affairs. And that kind of monolingual mindset really renders any access issues related to linguistic diversity invisible. So job interviewers, for instance, may not really have any particular idea about how difficult it is to learn a language, or they may not be capable to formulate like a set of criteria as to what kind of linguistic requirements are entailed in a job. So many of the case studies that I cite in that particular chapter are related to language being a gatekeeping mechanism to jobs that do not really require very sophisticated language skills. So, for instance, one of the case studies I have is with employment case in Germany, where a cleaner from Croatia background lost her job because her her German was deemed insufficient to do the job. However, no one ever sat down, and you know, she was supported by lawyers and this went through various labor courts and tribunals and whatnot. No one actually took it upon them to analyze what are the linguistic requirements of a cleaning job. Because the reality is you don't really need a whole lot of linguistic skills to clean a public pool. That was her job. And so the overall knowledge about how to think systematically about the role of language in conducting our social lives is very, very low. So we have a sort of low level of sophistication when it comes to language. And that is clearly one of the problems that speakers of minority languages or people who are second language speakers of the dominant language, that is one of the problems they are facing, that their problems are not even recognized. And so really raising the level of awareness, kind of talking to a wider audience about how we need to become more sophisticated in our understanding of linguistic challenges in social life was another key aim of my book.
Yes. Talking about this monolingual mindset or monolingual habitus, as I would elsewhere, you make the point early on when discussing linguistic diversity that there's an unspoken assumption out there that only some people are diverse. And at the back of that, the idea, I suppose, that diversity resides in individuals rather than in community. How has this been problematic for approaches to language policy?
Okay, so as a sociolinguist, what we know is that each and every one of us has a particular repertoire and a specific way of speaking. And all of us have slightly different experiences, and there is a lot of linguistic diversity, right? So that's what a society is made up of. Not everyone speaks the same. Not, in fact, not two people speak the same. However, this kind of diversity that is ubiquitous often gets overlooked, and particularly when we look at a society from the perspective of migration, from the perspective of multilingualism, we kind of lose sight of all the internal diversity. And it's important to keep in mind that when we talk about a language, if we talk about English, for instance, we are really making something that is incredibly diverse, sort of homogenizing it in a way. We are, putting it in a box, and that's for ease of reference, and there's nothing wrong with that. But it's at the same time important to keep in mind that all languages do not exist on a practical level. They are an abstraction. To talk about English or to talk about German or to talk about any other language with a name is always an abstraction that makes it easier for us to communicate, because, you know, we can't communicate all the detail and all the diversity. However, once we start talking about multilingualism, once we start talking about migration, once we start talking about second language speakers, we kind of forget that there is all this internal variation within any given language, and that all of us speak in specific ways that are part of who we are, that are related to what kind of experiences we had as we grew up, what kind of schooling we had, who we've been hanging out with, who we aspire to be. And so the way we speak is really as unique to each and every one of us as the way we dress, the way we look. So it's very much part of who we are. And this is something that often gets overlooked. And then when we start looking at a society from the migration angle, we all of a sudden make this important distinction between who is a native and who is not. And that then becomes related to questions of who is a legitimate member of a society and who isn't. And most Western societies, certainly since the 18th century, since state formation in Europe, colonization, the developments related to the Enlightenment, the Industrial Revolution, and so on and so forth, all these states have developed quite strong ideologies related to who is an insider and who is an outsider, who is a native and who is not a native. And language becomes part of the state definition. So someone who is a citizen or a native-born citizen, we see these people, irrespective of how they speak, we see them as more legitimate speakers of a language. And newcomers or people who have minority status or people who, you know, don't have equal citizenship rights are somehow also viewed as having a different linguistic repertoire. And they are the ones who then become seen as linguistically different. One of the examples that I use in the book is related to a term that we use in Australia, and that term is culled people. Culled people, that's an acronym that stands for C for culturally, A and L linguistically, D diverse. So culturally and linguistically diverse people. And then the definition that we find in policy discourses is that culturally and linguistically diverse people are first-generation migrants, the sons and daughters of migrants, so second generation, if you will, people where English might be spoken natively, who come from the Commonwealth, but who may not be familiar with Australian culture. And so it really is code for anyone who is not Anglo-Celtic or of Anglo-Celtic extraction. And so Anglo-Celts in Australia are somehow exempted from being diverse. Everyone else is diverse or seen as diverse, but people of Anglo-Celtic background and more generally European backgrounds, if they've been, you know, here for a couple of generations, they are not seen as diverse. Everyone else is. And there is only a small step to seeing that diversity not in neutral terms, as, you know, everyone's diverse, but as some sort of objectionable difference or difference that justifies questioning the legitimacy of the presence of those who are considered diverse.
Yes, it seems like we're returning to your point of earlier that language comes to stand for other things. Mm-hmm. Presumably you would say that variables that weren't necessarily considered to be meaningful if they merely allowed you to discern whether a white Anglo individual came from one city or another, somehow become loaded with an evaluative quality if they're being used to label and other groups of individuals. Would that be fair?
That would definitely be fair to say. I think it's also important to keep in mind that, you know, this is actually a quite recent development, that because until not so long ago, it was very well recognized that within a language, speakers of a variety labeled as dialect, so rural speakers in the UK, speakers from the north of England, that they did suffer disadvantage, and that within English there was social stratification related to native speaker English. But within a context where all of a sudden now our perspective is global, our perspective is so much on migration, I think the focus has really shifted towards disadvantage that is related, or inequality that is related to being a second language speaker of English, for instance.
That's interesting. It rather parallels the evolution of the definition of white as a ethnic group or not?
I think there are a lot of parallels with the way we see language and linguistic legitimacy and the way we see other forms of identity, particularly racial identity and also citizenship. I alluded to that one earlier, because very often we don't really make a judgment. If we are face to face with a second language speaker, so to speak, we don't make a judgment really on the basis of the way they speak. We kind of see them speaking as representatives of a particular culture or a particular racial identity. There is this wonderful study that I quote quite early in the book that was conducted by Rubin at a Florida university in the early 1990s. And what Rubin did is he audio recorded a short undergraduate psychology lecture, a couple of minutes long. And the recording was by a white woman who was a native speaker of American English and who spoke in a standard American accent, sort of Midwestern American accent. And then this audio recording was played to two groups of undergraduate students. One group of undergraduate students listened to that audio recording as they saw an image of a white woman on a screen. And so the assumption that they were led to believe that that white woman was the speaker in the audio recording. And after they'd listened to the audio recording, they were asked to rate the language, the lecture structure, and their learning experience. And the students who listened to that audio recording against the picture of the white woman, they, were quite positive about that lecture. They said the lecture was well spoken, it was very clearly enunciated, they understood everything, they liked the structure of the lecture, they felt it was clearly structured, and when it came to evaluating their learning experience, they felt they had learned something and there were key points that had been made in the lecture and they had understood them. Now, exactly the same audio recording was then played to another group of undergraduate students. This time, the second group of undergraduate students, when they listened to the lecture, they saw the image of an Asian woman. So for them, the impression was that the Asian woman was delivering the lecture. Now, the audio input had not changed at all. All that had changed was the visual image of who they thought was talking in that audio recording. And it's unbelievable how different their evaluation was. So a number of the students in the second scenario actually said they didn't like the lecture because of the Asian accent of the lecturer. So they felt there was an accent present, although none was present in the linguistic stimulus. They commented that the lecture wasn't well structured. Again, a couple of students even specifically said they didn't like the lecture structure because it was structured in a circular way and there didn't seem to be a point in it. And the second group rated their learning experience much, much lower. They felt they hadn't really learned anything much because the lecture was so difficult to understand in their view. And so what this study tells us really is that what we hear is not something that is objectively out there, but when we speak to someone else, when we perceive the language proficiency, the way someone else speaks, what we hear is in the eye of the beholder, partly, if you will. So all kinds of prior knowledge is activated. And that, in a sense, makes the question of linguistic diversity and social stratification very, very difficult for a linguistics that does not take the social into account, because none of this can be explained if you just purely look at language as some sort of objective stimulus. So it's very important to also consider social ideologies, to consider social structures, and to try and examine the interplay between these two social realities.
I want to take the opportunity then to ask, in chapter four, workplace, here and elsewhere in the book, you link the discussion with a much broader socioeconomic critique, in that case on the functioning of the international labour markets and elsewhere on the encroachment of neoliberalism more generally. How central do you see that as being to your own intellectual project?
Very central because it's very central to the social world we live in at the moment. And so one of my aims was that, many of the things I'm talking about, like that language structures social inequality, that language can serve as a pretext for other forms of exclusion. None of that is particularly new and is a point that has been made again and again by sociolinguists, at least since the middle of the 20th century. However, what I see as new is that I try to explore these issues in a fundamentally changed world, one that is now characterized by the dominance of globalization, if you want to call it, by significant migration streams, by certainly a perception that, and probably also a reality that the world, more people are on the move, and we have more access to a global imagination. So our reference point is no longer just the national. Our reference point really has become the global. And within these developments, language also has taken on a new meaning. One point that I alluded to earlier on was that language proficiency can become a pretext for racial discrimination. When I said, job applicant may be rejected, not because of the color of their skin, because we are not allowed to say that, but it's illegal. But if we still kind of want to reject them on the basis of racial discrimination, then language becomes a pretext. And language is much more difficult to contest. So, as I said, if someone says you are not qualified for the job because your English isn't good enough, or whatever language is the dominant language is not good enough, that's very difficult to contest, because on what basis do I sort of say, oh, this is actually how qualified is the interviewer to make that judgment, or how relevant, as I said in the example with the cleaner, how relevant is language actually to the job performance? So language has taken on new meanings, and part of the neoliberal globalization project has, of course, been to also change our culture to become more competitive, and in a sense to highlight individual merit, to highlight that, or to find social justification by saying whatever we do is the responsibility of the individual. So social inequality is no longer seen as, or no longer widely seen as, the result of unequal social relations, of class relations, but rather we've really gone back to the 19th century view that poverty is the responsibility of the individual. And now language is uniquely suited to justify such inequalities that are related to personal responsibility, because language and your language proficiency and your language resources can be constructed as something that is your personal responsibility in the way that other aspects of your identity cannot. So obviously, we would not say that your gender or your racial appearance is your personal responsibility, but the way you speak can be constructed as your personal responsibility. You know, have you tried hard enough? Have you learned hard enough? Have you invested enough time? And that kind of personal responsibility approach means that we overlook that not everyone has the same preconditions when they learn another language, not the same access, and that the outcomes of language learning are pretty much just as much a matter of luck, if you will, as many other aspects of your identity. So the success of adult language learning is related to aspects such as your age, the older you are, the more difficult it becomes to learn another language, the level of your prior education, usually the more highly educated you are, the easier it is to learn another language in a new context, particularly if it is a formal language learning context, how much time you have, like what your socioeconomic situation is. If you have to go out and work any kind of job just to make ends meet, obviously you don't have time to invest in formal language learning, in classroom education. There is also this belief that actually having a job, any kind of job, will improve language proficiency. Now, that is something that a lot of the research I refer to, a lot of our research that we've done here at Macquarie University, has actually thoroughly debunked, because it depends on what kind of job you have. And if we look at jobs such as cleaning, for instance, which is very often a kind of entry-level job for new migrants, the way outsourced industrial cleaning is structured nowadays, it gives you very, very limited language learning opportunities, very limited interactional opportunities. So it's not an opportunity to improve your language. It's just something you have to do that in a way takes away from your language learning. And because the reduction of the welfare state, because the neoliberal transformation of the economy has been so fundamental to the way we live our lives today, certainly language has become more important, and that's why it is quite central.
But to skip ahead to the later chapters where you address the question of participation in mm-hmm. society, particularly, I read you as being very skeptical about the way in which language has been commoditized and is being sold as a guarantee of participation.
Mm-hmm. That's certainly the case. If we maybe go back to the chapter about education, I mean, one of the key drivers of the economy in countries like Australia nowadays, also in the UK, is education has become a very important export of these countries, and international education is certainly something that we see as very, very meaningful and a good way to achieve globalization, internationalization, and so on and so forth. Now, many of the students who come to Anglophone countries in particular, they come under the assumption that if they improve their English, then that will open all kinds of doors for them. However, as I said, that's not necessarily the case. So a lot of the studies that we look at that I cite in the study, a lot of the research that we've done here at Macquarie really shows that it can be very difficult to improve your English in a context that is often seen as an ideal language learning context, namely the one of higher education. And that is related to the fact that as a language learner, you always have a dual task. The dual task is to improve your language as you do something else. To improve your language as you learn and study for a course, for instance, or to improve your language as you perform being a worker and a colleague. And that's not an easy feat to achieve, because usually you jeopardize one or the other. If you are a low or intermediate proficiency learner of a language, it's very difficult to project a competent perception or a competent persona as a student or a competent persona as a colleague. And so people often may actually feel like, do I talk now, and do I take any kind of interactional opportunity as a language learning opportunity, even if I sound kind of stupid and insane, or do I protect my core identity as a competent student and keep quiet, for instance? And all these challenges of interaction, and it's not only that the language learner is facing all these questions on a continuous basis, it's also that interlocutors are not necessarily, always supportive and inclusive, and most of us don't have the time and don't know how to support the language learning of someone who is sort of an everyday interactant. And that really is part of the challenge of participation that I think we are only just starting to address, and again something that I wanted to just highlight more in my book, that often the question of linguistic diversity and social justice is addressed as one of rights, that all kinds of languages have rights and so on and so forth. But many of the challenges of community participation, in particular, challenges that come up in daily intercultural communication when you have different levels of proficiency, these are not challenges that are really amenable to a rights approach. What they are amenable to, in my view, and why I'm still optimistic about this project, is really a broadening of our approach and the broadening of the view, both on the part of language learners and those who interact with language learners, that language is very central, that we need to be patient with each other, and that linguistic diversity also has so much to contribute to enriching a society and to enriching our interactions. So, you know, to kind of open people's minds also to the excitement of linguistic difference and the way this can actually also improve our communications if we just try to get away from this perspective that it's just all too hard, too difficult, and that those who are not as proficient as everyone else or who are stigmatized as lacking proficiency, that they somehow or another don't have an equal right to contribute. That everyone who is, you know, in a university classroom or who is a citizen has an equal right to participate. And we all need to work to make that happen.
Yes, indeed. And I'd like to cut back on that topic to the subject of education more generally. And bilingual education. In respect of testing in schools, for example, largely this monolingual mindset is very strongly in place, and you sharply criticise the misapplication of majority language tests to children who speak minority languages in context. I would be interested to know a little bit more about your views on that. Do you see it as a problem of the lack of provision of the appropriate tests, or the way the results stigmatise, or the logic of testing at all?
Generally, I think in education, we are now in a space where accountability is very, very important. League tables are very, very important. Scores are very important. And we kind of believe our politicians and policymakers in public discourse, we find this idea that everything needs to be ranked and standardized. Testing really is the ultimate evidence that we have on educational quality. Now, that has a number of negative consequences for children who do not speak the dominant language. And that may be because they are new migrants and just do not have proficiency in the dominant language. That may be because they are minoritized in other ways and speak a language other than the dominant language at home, or that may be because, you know, they are of working class backgrounds or whatever and speak some sort of dialect and some sort of variation of the majority language that doesn't quite fit the middle class norm that is being tested in those tests. So all these kids are really being left behind by standardized testing. And we have a lot of evidence that schools who, you know, have high populations of second language speakers or dialect speakers, stigmatized variety speakers of disadvantaged varieties, that those schools, they underperform and on standardized tests. In one way that teachers and principals and the school system tries to deal with their underperformance is not actually by teaching them, but by getting them out of the testing system. And we have a lot of evidence that, you know, people are just trying to not show the performance of minority speakers on tests and try to keep them away from tests because they underperform. Now, why do they underperform? That actually is related to the logic of testing, because the logic of standardized testing is one of everyone's the same. Just to give you an example, and one that is also in the book, is Australian research with speakers of Aboriginal varieties of English in the Northern Territory. In that test that is used nationwide in Australia, one example that I remember right now is there was a testing item that included picket fences. Now, picket fences don't exist in, you know, remote Northern Australia. So just certain testing items that are supposed to be equal for everyone, actually, they just don't exist in the lived reality of certain children. Or a more telling example that I've also got in the book is actually of an African refugee child in the US, in whose reading test there was a reading passage about Neil Armstrong landing on the moon and traveling there on a spaceship named the Eagle. And that was sort of the input text. And then the first question was, is this text fictional or non-fictional? Now, of course, the answer is it's non-fictional. And then all the other test responses followed from that. However, that particular kid, as I said, an African refugee child who had only recently arrived in the US, he actually did understand the passage, but he later explained to the teacher, this is a fictional text because people don't go to the moon and they don't ride on the back of eagles. So that little kid had actually perfectly understood the input text, and he had also understood the difference between fictional and non-fictional writing. However, because he had a different kind of knowledge of the world than the average American kid, he still got it all wrong. Because once he had answered that the text was fictional, then all the other questions that followed from having understood that the text was non-fictional, he got all of those wrong. And so he, you know, completely failed the test, completely underperformed. And this is not the fault of a kid. This is the fault of an education system that kind of is under the illusion that everything has to be standardized and that standardized test scores are meaningful. Because if we were to look at this particular kid and his performance in any other way than the kind of national standardized approach, we would say, yeah, he did well. You know, he understood the text. He understood the difference between fictional and non-fictional writing. He just had a different knowledge of the world. And so test scores are very, very problematic because they hide knowledge that is there and they render some knowledge as valuable. And very often that's sort of the middle class knowledge that test writers have in mind. And they render other knowledges as invisible, as invaluable. And then, of course, the consequence is that if you are a child that continuously experiences failure, despite your best effort, you know, to go back to this little refugee kid, very enthusiastic, very bright, but turns out he's all wrong in the test. Then, of course, that also creates a cumulative burden, and the end result is very high dropout rates for second language learners. And we know that to complete high school or not is still the best predictor of leading a productive life later in life. So if you create educational disadvantage, and if we don't actually do better, and that's, you know, I'm speaking of sort of all of us, all Western societies really that see significant migration. If we don't do better to integrate minority children in schools and enable them to succeed in school, the consequences are, you know, quite dire for every one of us and are paid in more fractious societies.
Yes, indeed. I wanted to touch on another aspect of bilingual education that you mentioned, and which is relevant to some of the points you were making there, I think, which is the issue of parental input, which seems to be a major determinant in whether children achieve a desirable state of high-level functional bilingualism.
Mm-hmm.
What's often struck me about that, not only from what you write, but also from sort of personal anecdotal experience, mm-hmm. is that it seems to perpetuate social advantages down the generations.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something you feel that schooling can rectify realistically?
Well, it's a difficult question, I guess. You know, not every social problem can be rectified in schools, and we are all overburdening schools anyway. So in that sense, I do not necessarily have a view, or I don't have any specific knowledge to say, can schools rectify generational disadvantage to any degree. At the moment, what we can say is that many schools serve to entrench disadvantage. But maybe to go back to your bilingual education question, one thing that's quite interesting about bilingual education is that bilingualism per se has come to be seen quite differently depending on who has the bilingualism. So, for middle-class families, bilingualism really has come to be seen as something very desirable, an additional edge, an additional advantage that we can confer on children. And it's very often that the bilingualism of the dominant is highly valued. If now, if you're following politics, Hillary Clinton recently picked her running mate, and I forget his name now, but there was a lot being made of the fact that he was bilingual in Spanish, and everyone is very excited about the fact that this white non-Latino senator is bilingual in Spanish. And on some of the Twitter feeds I followed, there was a lot of, you know, comment on that, that if he were Latino, his bilingualism wouldn't be half as valuable. And so the value of bilingual education is really very much tied to who you are. And we encourage the bilingualism of the dominant, but we actually discourage and devalue the bilingualism of those who are marginalized in other ways. And one thing that we know in bilingual education is, of course, that parental input, as you said, is very, very important, that the home language is very important. And what's so interesting, if we look at the advice literature, for instance, is that dominant parents are very often advised to speak a minority language with their child and speak the minority language all the time and whatnot. But migrant parents receive exactly the opposite advice. They are advised to speak the dominant language with their children, not speak the home language, not speak their native language, but speak the majority language. And the consequence can often actually be a real poverty of linguistic stimulus and a real breakdown of intergenerational communication. In a study of ESL mothers in Canada a couple of years ago that I also cite in the book, Sandra Kuritsen interviewed mothers from all kinds of migrant backgrounds, and many of them had taken the advice to only speak English with their kids. And many of them found that as their children grew older and grew into teenagers and adults, they actually didn't have a strong linguistic connection because the English of the mothers was not good enough to have a kind of, you know, adult conversation and conversation about difficult topics that you must have with teenagers and young adults. But on the other hand, because they had only spoken English to their children, the children didn't have high levels of proficiency in the heritage language. And so the children didn't have the proficiency to have a difficult conversation or an adult conversation with their parents in the heritage language. And so the result, of course, is linguistic alienation and breakdown. And so we really need to, I think, also be better at valuing the bilingualism of everyone and not only seeing it as, you know, it's good for you if you are advantaged in other ways, then it's an additional advantage. But for those who are struggling already, we're kind of saying bilingualism is not for you because you'd only end up with a deficit in both languages anyways.
Yes, it's a very unfortunate situation in terms of how it's communicated, isn't it? I would love to ask many more questions, but our time is nearly up. So I really must ask you what you're working on at the moment.
Yeah, so I'm still very excited about this book just having come out. There are two key projects I'm working on at the moment. One is actually a revised edition of another book I wrote a couple of years ago, An Introduction to Intercultural Communication. So I'm in the process of revising that, and that will come out with Edinburgh University Press next year. And then a more long-term project I'm working on is related to linguistic privilege. As you will have seen, the book ends kind of with questions. How can those of us who are linguistically privileged actually support a more equal society? And so I'm interested in how, on the one hand, linguistic privilege shapes our views of language learning. In language learning, we often have, in applied linguistics, in TESOL, we often have this kind of implicit view of the learner as, you know, an able-bodied white guy who has no other care in the world apart from language learning. And that view, I think, is actually both theoretically and practically quite pernicious, because it means that it obscures the challenges related to, you know, not having this kind of wonderful privileged identities related to language learning. I'm also interested in linguistic privilege related to the British Raj and colonialism. I've sort of got a side interest in the history of the Middle East, and one of the projects I'm working on is how British colonial officers learned languages such as Persian and Arabic in the 19th century, how they were trained to serve, and what kind of attitudes they had towards learning those languages, and how those are related to their privileged position. So that's sort of in the future and the long-term interest of mine.
Well, it's a fascinating array of material across space and time, and I look forward to hearing more about it. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Ingrid Piller about linguistic diversity and social justice. This is Chris Cummins for New Books in Language saying thank you for listening.